we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
The most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." So said Ronald Reagan. I'm Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to this episode of America Out Loud Pulse. It's time to talk. As of May 2021, only about a fourth of Americans said they can trust the government in Washington to do what's right. Waivers and favors and off-the-cuff rule changes and the bungled COVID response validate that distrust. Bureaucratic incompetence and cronyism aren't the only reasons we should wonder about the government's opinion, about us, about the value of its citizens. Their bigger agendas seem to take precedence over us. No matter how much we rely on government services, really, other than the military, deep down in our hearts, we know we need an escape hatch from government incompetence or really outright breach of trust. You might say, well, gee, bad things that government did, they're all in the past. But it matters because dangerous government policies are going on today with masks and tests and vaccines and manipulation of really basic COVID statistics. And now we have the Department of Homeland Security setting up a disinformation governance board in an attempt to combat misinformation online. But who's the purveyor of misinformation? The government hiding what it's done in the past, or the government hiding its current questionable deeds under the banner of public health? Let's just talk about some of the things our venerable government has done. We'll start with Operation Sea Spray and some of its cousins. In 1950, for one full week in September, a U.S. Navy crew released bacteria 2 miles off the coast of San Francisco. They used a bacterium called Serratia marcescens. Remember that name because it might be fun for you all to look this up after this podcast. They use Serratia because the spores of the bacteria are red, so you can see where it is. So why did they do this? They wanted to determine if a big city was susceptible to a bioweapon attack by terrorists. Well, I say, well, who's the terrorist? The government didn't tell anybody they were doing that. They monitored over 40 locations around San Francisco, and it looked like just in a week, millions of spores were inhaled. The government assumed it was harmless, but there's no record of the Navy ever informing the public health officials of the test. Some patients did get sick. In October, just a month after they released all these bacteria, 11 San Francisco Bay Area residents checked into Stanford Hospital, and they had bladder infections. And what was the infection with? Serratia marcescens. This is a very rare infection. All but one patient survived, fortunately. Now, in San Francisco, cases of pneumonia started to pop up. It was mainly in drug addicts, and so people didn't pay a whole lot of attention, and that lasted through the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And I'll tell you, this is personal. I had one of those patients when I was a student at UC San Francisco. In fact, it was my first patient that died. I still remember his name and face. He was a drug addict, kind of a nice guy. He had infection of his heart valves. What was the infection with? Serratia. The medical resident on the case was totally baffled. It couldn't figure out. I mean, everybody kind of knew drug addicts are more susceptible to unusual bacteria, but where'd the serratia come from? Well, came from our own government. Of course, we didn't know that. It took this poor guy about 3 weeks to die. Over the next 20 years, there were similar tests all across the country. Now, this isn't a conspiracy theory. I'm not a wacko. There were Senate hearings in 1977 where all of this was revealed. The Army submitted a huge report that said they did this to unwitting citizens just so they could learn how to wage biological warfare and, of course, how we defend against it. During these subcommittee hearings, the Army said that between 1949 and 1969, they did open-air tests of biological agents. How many times? Not once, not twice, not three times, not four times, but 239 times. And this wasn't out in the country, you know, like where aliens are supposed to land. These were in populated civilian areas, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Washington, D.C., New York subway system. No holds barred. They had another one that was called Project SHAD, and that stood for Shipboard Hazard and Defense. And this was part of this larger project, Project 112. I tell you these names, you know, write them down if you want to look them up. And they put another bacteria out, and this was called Bacillus globigi. It's supposed to not be harmful to people, but again, they released this San Francisco, New York, DC, Pennsylvania Turnpike, and other places around the country. They secretly released it in a bus terminal in Washington, DC, and passengers were exposed. And the passengers that were exposed to the bacteria went to 39 cities around the United States in the 2 weeks after this attack. There was another bacterium, Bacillus subtilis, and with a special little variant that's also supposed to be harmless. They put that in the subway system. This sounds like something out of a CIA handbook. They put it in light bulbs and dropped the bacteria onto the tracks right in Midtown Manhattan. The bacteria was carried for miles throughout the subway system. Again, this came out in an Army report where they admitted that similar covert attacks with these disease-causing agents during peak traffic periods could be expected to expose large numbers of people to infection and subsequent illness or death. They admitted that they used Army personnel and their families by spraying germs in the air over bases, including Fort Detrick. Now, we've heard Fort Detrick before in a lot of stories, whether they be about COVID or a whole lot of other incidents that occurred. So this makes me think about the current push for COVID vaccines in the military. It seems like the military, the folks that signed up, they signed up to help guard our freedoms, to help protect the country. But did they sign up to be guinea pigs in biological experiments, including experimental COVID vaccines? I don't know. I doubt that they did. So the Army justifies this by saying the bacteria dumps were essential to fill the knowledge gap. They said they were safe. I repeat, just like they're saying with the new technology in the COVID RNA vaccines, they say they are safe. I suppose we should ask the people who have thousands of adverse effects, but that's another conversation. The Army admitted that three laboratory workers at Fort Detrick died from diseases contracted in the 1950s and 1960s. These were apparently from these harmless bacteria. There were only a few workers that died, just those three, but another 500 workers connected with these biological activities became sick with various infections. President Nixon stopped the program in 1969, and it makes me wonder, if he hadn't stopped this, how many more springs would we have had? How many more deaths? How many more illnesses with bizarre bacteria that are supposedly harmless? Now, we'll leave that horrible episode behind us and move on to another episode in our American history. A couple weeks ago, I did a podcast on eugenics and mentioned forced sterilizations. If you didn't hear that podcast, hope you'll go back and listen to it. We'll talk about forced sterilizations again. I find it to be one of the most egregious things that our public health has ever done, particularly in light of the fact that there's so much emphasis on how to get abortions and that abortion is the best thing since sliced bread and, oh, how awful if we can't have abortions. And I think these same people touting this are the same people that are, well, I should say were and perhaps are involved in forced sterilizations in this country. And it doesn't sound so bizarre. I mean, we have California and Maryland putting out laws saying it's okay to kill babies after they're born. So why not sterilize people even before they get pregnant? Hey, that might save even more money. So this all began in 1907, these forced sterilizations, and it started in Indiana. And they passed a law, and then other states kind of one by one started passing their own laws. In the beginning, these laws only applied to the so-called feeble-minded. So across the country, by the 1920s, almost two-thirds of the states had forced sterilization laws, and they were mostly for psychiatric institutions. The heads of these institutions could sterilize anybody they decided was a social misfit. One example that made history was Virginia's Eugenical Sterilization Act. And they admitted they passed it as part of a cost-saving strategy, and it was supposed to relieve the tax burden of public institutions. Frankly, it sounds to me like the same thing they're doing with old folks who are chewing up the Medicare dollars, and it just looks like a good way to save money. Get rid of them quick. But again, that's a whole nother story. But just keep this in mind. People think this way. And a lot of times when you say something like, oh, they're culling the herd, they're killing off the old people, they're killing off the people who are sick and, you know, like they call useless eaters, and think, oh, come on, that's crazy. Well, it's not crazy because we've done it in the past. These laws, and in particular that Virginia law, focused on defective persons, and their reproduction would be a menace to society. The law authorized sterilization of the socially inadequate, the feeble-minded, insane, criminalistic, epileptic, inebriate, diseased, blind, deaf, deformed, and dependent, including orphans, ne'er-do-wells, tramps, the homeless, and paupers. Think of that list. Gee, Helen Keller would be on that list. And my goodness, right now we're trying our level best to help out homeless people all across the United States. And as for paupers, well, this is why we have welfare. We have Medicaid that pays for people who can't afford their health insurance. So these are people that they want to sterilize. Now, who says that people might not want those same sort of folks sterilized today? Certainly if they had offspring that might chew up more government dollars, the government wouldn't be too pleased. They've never said this, but there is a history. The Supreme Court Justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes, he was a progressive icon. He's someone whose words are on the side of the law school I went to. His words are on the side of justice buildings all over the country. And he upheld that law. He said, Carrie Bell, that was the plaintiff, her welfare and that of society will be promoted by her sterilization. It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute her degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. Interestingly, as the facts show, Carrie's mother, one of those generations, was a prostitute, but she wasn't feeble-minded. Carrie had a job, and she was an avid reader, did crossword puzzles, and her so-called feeble-minded daughter was on the honor roll. When we come back, we'll go more into this ugly chapter of our history. I want to thank you for listening to America Out Loud. We have free apps on Apple, Android, and Alexa, and you can hear Pulse every weekday at 5 with an encore presentation at 10 p.m. That's Eastern time. And the next morning at 8 a.m. on iHeartRadio. All shows go direct to podcast in 24 hours. They're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, iHeart, and others. So make it easy. Just bookmark AmericaOutLoud.com.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
Surely, if you can't find it here, you can't find it anywhere. We are the pulse and voice of everyday American thought. So you can listen in on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cells REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Now back to those forced sterilizations that, thanks to the United States Supreme Court, that bastion of justice, was okay. It was constitutional. So then the sterilization started to go beyond the mentally challenged. Hispanics and Blacks, well, they were easy targets, especially in the 1970s after Medicaid, government-sponsored healthcare, funded planning, family planning services, and those services included sterilization. That's fine if that's what you want. But some patients were bullied into consenting. They said that their welfare benefits and their medical care would be taken away unless they were sterilized. Sometimes tubal ligations were done during cesarean sections, unknown to the patients. These were called Mississippi appendectomies. The Indian Health Service, of course, had a captive audience. And in 3 years in the 70s, almost 3,400 Native American women, including minors, were sterilized without permission or with pathetically defective consent forms. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of government-funded forced sterilizations, probably at least 60,000. And the last legal one on the books was in 1981. Now, of course, they still sterilize people in prison. And as late as 2004, women were told if they got sterilized, they'll get probation or they could get sentence reductions. Well, I mean, talk about coercion. This is disgusting behavior on the part of our government. Just keep that in mind. Now we're going to talk about something that I'm sure most people have heard the name of. It's the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. Talk about something I would have to use the word heinous for. This is it. The official name of this study was the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male. It lasted from 1932 to 1972. Yes, modern times. This was a study by the U.S. Public Health Service, and it recruited 400 mainly poor, illiterate Black sharecroppers with syphilis. They used them as lab animals. They set up the study in Macon County because they estimated that 35% of the population had syphilis. So they got men between the ages of 25 and 60, they told them that they had quote unquote bad blood, but not that they necessarily had a serious disease. Now, bad blood, it's kind of funny. When I first saw that in medical school, I had no idea what that was. And I even had some patients tell me they were told they had bad blood. And it was just sort of a term, and mostly Southern, that included anemia, syphilis, fatigue, and other random conditions. So that's all they told the people they have. That was the extent of the informed consent. So they were in this study, which ultimately would ruin their lives, but they got free medical exams, free meals, and free burial insurance. The thing that's interesting and disgusting is that this is the U.S. Public Health Service. They believe that all Black people, regardless of their education or background or economic situations, couldn't be convinced to get treatment for syphilis. So that's kind of how they justified the study. They said it was a study in nature rather than an experiment. So they just wanted to observe the natural progression of syphilis within a community that wouldn't seek treatment anyway. How racist is that? Our government. So at first, a doctor, I'll give you his name because he's a hero in his own way. He started the study. He thought it would be a good idea. His name is Dr. Taliaferro Clark. And he only wanted it to go on for about 6 or 7 months. Then after 7 months, his other colleagues in the public health service said, no, we need to keep it going. We need to keep it going. So Dr. Clark quit. This is sort of a lesson, little aside here, that it's for us to think about what to do when we're confronted with stuff like that as doctors. And I'm sure a lot of us, especially those of us who have to work in a hospital, when we're told to do something, and I'm sure it's nothing as awful as this Tuskegee study, but certainly within our time period, there's certain things they want us to do, certain rules, their drug formularies, and don't want us to use certain medications because they cost too much, all this stuff. What do you do? How do you stand up to the man? Sometimes you have to walk away. Sometimes if you can get your colleagues together and get enough people on board, you can fight. And this is an example of somebody who spoke out and he did walk away from it. And it's too bad more people didn't. One of the things they did in this study, maybe it made people feel good. I don't know how anyone could feel good. They started giving all the patients ineffective medicines. They gave them ointments and mercury treatments that people knew didn't work, but it would make the people believe that they were getting some sort of treatment. They even sent out a Black nurse to drive them to and from appointments, to bring them food, which since when it started, you know, it was right in the Depression. So people at this point were almost ready to do anything for food. I'm going to read you some quotes if you think I'm exaggerating about the evil intent of some of these folks. When I read these quotes, I thought, gee, did this come from a book about Nazi doctors? No, it was American doctors. This is an unparalleled opportunity for carrying on this piece of scientific research, which cannot be duplicated anywhere in the world. This was from the Surgeon General. One of his assistants said, they were subjects, not patients. They were clinical research material, not sick people. Another director said, as I see it, we have no further interest in these patients until they die. It was criminal. Multiple times throughout the experiment, researchers actively worked to make sure the patients didn't receive treatment. They gave all the doctors in Macon County lists of the subject and asked the doctors not to treat them. In 1940, they actually gave this list to the Alabama Health Department. In 1941, many of the men were drafted, so the military exam, the entrance exam, showed their positive syphilis test. So the researchers had the men removed from the army rather than let their syphilis be treated. Worse, and a true crime, if the rest of it isn't bad enough, was in 1947 when penicillin became the drug of choice and everybody knew it, researchers didn't offer it to the subjects. And they didn't give them the choice of quitting the study. And then, you know, we even had the Nuremberg Code after the hideous Nazi experiments. And the Nuremberg Code said it's not ethical to deny patients informed consent, but the public health department never gave any more consent to these patients. It's like the show must go on, the research must go on, and it didn't matter what was ethical. The men were never given adequate treatment for the disease, and all the subjects' syphilis remained untreated so the government could track the natural progression. Now, fortunately, by the 50s, maybe a third, not quite, of the participants had received treatments, you know, one way or another. And the researchers tried so hard to keep them from going out and getting penicillin. And they made these excuses saying Black men were too stoic to see a doctor. And the reason these guys didn't go to a doctor is, of course, they thought they were already getting treated. They thought that mercury and ointment was doing something for them. Then, you know, we're getting into modern times now. By 1965, the Public Health Service said, it's too late to give them penicillin. And besides, the syphilis has gone too far, wouldn't do any good anyway. That's not true. Penicillin is and was recommended for all stages of syphilis and could have stopped the disease progression. So, it's funny. I sit here like speechless when I have to repeat this stuff because it's hard to imagine it's true. It's like something that would be in a novel or some other country, but not our great country, not the United States. This whole study and what they were doing was leaked by a whistleblower in 1972. That's why it stopped. Either most of the folks were dead, old, but the whistleblower is what stopped it. He told the New York Times, and that brought this study to an end. When it stopped, out of the 400, about 70 of the subjects were still alive, but 128 had died of syphilis or its complications. They infected their wives. Some of the children had congenital syphilis. So, what happened? They ended up doing a congressional, yet another congressional hearing. Congressional hearing said the study violated all ethics. And fortunately, the families did a huge class action suit and they got $10 million settlement out of court from the government. That certainly won't bring back those people or their life. And President Clinton issued a formal apology. Well, that's, small compensation for what our U.S. Public Health Service did to these people. So let's move on to a different topic. We have vaccine missteps, and I'm not talking about the COVID vaccine. This is back in 1976. All this might sound familiar, but scientists predicted that there was going to be a pandemic of a new strain of influenza called the swine flu. And after this whole period, now a lot of historians call it the flu epidemic that never was. President Ford, his advisors told him that this big flu was coming and it might be as bad as the Spanish flu of the early 1900s. So, mind you, it's 1976, it's an election year. He was talked into putting out a vaccine that was developed way too fast. He made the decision to make the immunization compulsory. And spring of an election year that all of this happened. This was the National Swine Flu Immunization Program. They had this whole program launched in about 7 months, and 40 million people got vaccinated against the swine flu. By the time the immunizations began, the epidemic never really happened. Now, this was by the fall. Legionnaires' disease was spreading all over the country, and everyone was worried about that. But no, people had to have those vaccinations. Well, the vaccination campaign was linked to 450 cases of a nerve disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome. That's where you start to get paralyzed, and it starts in the feet, works all the way up, paralyzes your diaphragm so you can't breathe. And then over time, in most cases, the paralysis comes back down. But of course, that's a month, sometimes more, where people are on the ventilator waiting for this paralysis to go away. Well, when the Guillain-Barré was picked up, they stopped the vaccinations. Now, it's very interesting. 450 cases out of 40 million people, and they stopped the vaccinations. I just have one question. I always try to say, I try not to say the C word, but there's so many things that have gone on in the past that are hitting us now. I wish they'd stop the COVID vaccinations, the big push. The only good thing about what's happening now is the COVID vaccinations are not mandatory. And everyone remember that. But we had Guillain-Barré with a vaccination before, and the government had the good sense to stop it. Maybe we should start thinking that way now. Before we go on to our next great government, public health, what should I say? I don't even know what to call it. Bad news. I just want to thank everybody for listening. We've got the free apps on Apple, Android, Alexa, and you know you can hear us every weekday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and again at 10 p.m. and on iHeartRadio the next morning. So all shows go directly to podcasts, and in 24 hours, and we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, iHeart, and many others.
Is a record player the best way to listen to music? Of course not. So why are you still taking vitamins that haven't been upgraded since the 1930s? Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, it's time to upgrade to Healthy Cells pill-free, patent-pending microgel supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. They taste great, convenient on the go, and they're more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Many things we hear are lies. We know one thing is true. Viruses exist and people get sick. Look, there's no guaranteed way to keep from getting sick, but there is a way to reduce your chances. Cofix RX, the original povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray that you hear Dr. McCullough talking about, provides an additional, invisible layer of protection from colds, flu, coronaviruses, and more. Click the banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off. Stay protected with Cofix RX.
We had an experimental measles vaccine. This experimental measles vaccine in 1989, again, modern times. This was sponsored by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente. They came to Los Angeles and got 1,500 six-month-old Black and Hispanic babies. Let me tell you what this vaccine was, okay? We already had a measles vaccine, but there was another one, unlicensed, experimental, and I'll call it for short, it was the EZ vaccine. And the World Health Organization had recommended it. It had a higher amount of measles in it. And it had been being tested in Mexico and Gambia, Togo, Senegal, and of course, Haiti, all through the 80s. And so they wanted to compare this EZ vaccine with the standard vaccine we were already using in this country. They were trying to see if they could get more immunity in kids who were younger than a year old and try to figure out the right dosage. Again, sound familiar? Well, moving along. At that time, the routine age for receiving the first dose of measles vaccine was 15 months. Okay. So 12 months at the earliest. These were six-month-old babies. So they distributed a brochure to parents. The form didn't say that the EZ vaccine was experimental or unlicensed. The form didn't say that we already had a vaccine that worked on other kids. They said 200 million children around the world have received this vaccine, and Los Angeles County will be the first place in the United States where it's being offered. The parents signed the consent, but they were not told of the two vaccines they might get, that one was experimental and one was unlicensed. There is a physician who was in a vaccine public interest safety group, and he blew the whistle. Data had come out already from Senegal and Haiti that said there was increased death among female infants receiving that EZ vaccine. In fact, it was 80% higher than in lower dose vaccines. This data had been put in the Lancet Medical Journal in 1991. And interestingly, Los Angeles didn't stop the study till after that. So that data was available. If it got published in 1991, that means they knew in 1990, but they still didn't stop the study. They've never really been able to prove what other complications, of course, other than death, that these children had. But finally, the study stopped. And the CDC director in 1996, I love how they put these things in the third person, he said, a mistake was made, and he was shocked. He said there was no ill intent in not telling the parents that the vaccine hadn't been licensed, and they wanted to contact all the families and tell them. And now they wonder why minority communities are suspicious of the government, suspicious of government-sponsored research, suspicious, of course, of these new vaccines. Here, when right in front of their eyes, the CDC harmed babies, it violated federal law, and completely trampled on parental rights. Well, if you hadn't heard enough, we'll just let you know about the VA. Everybody hears about the VA, and it was in the news a couple of years ago, and it sort of trails off as these things do. The VA serves about 6 million veterans, and I'm sure has trained practically every doctor in the United States. If you go to medical school where there's a VA hospital, you all have rotations through the VA. And most people love it because the vets are always so nice and thankful. And you get a chance to feel like you're truly helping well-deserving people out. Now, the VA had always had problems as far as getting appointments. Because admittedly, there aren't tons of VA hospitals. A lot of people have to drive a long way to get there. And so appointments were a problem. So under a 1996 law, they said that veterans had to be seen within 30 days of calling for an appointment. 5 years after the law passed, there was a Government Accountability Office study. It showed that most of the appointments still didn't meet that mark. So they had of course, a big congressional hearing, and they found out, this was in 2002, that at least 300,000 veterans nationwide had been put on waiting lists or had to wait for over, guess what? 6 months for a medical appointment. The Office of Inspector General for the VA had reports. Now we're moving on to 2005 and 2007 and 2008. And they figured out that the waiting times that were even reported were unreliable. Why? Because they noticed that there were at least 24 tactics that had been used to change and do some wiggle room to make it look like the wait times weren't as long as they were. There was a memo. How dumb is it of people to write these things in memos? In 2010, about the problem of, quote, gaming strategies, close quote, inside the VA to meet the performance goals. At one Colorado clinic, employees said they were instructed by the business office staff to find an open date for an appointment, mark it down as though that was the desired date, so it looked like there was no waiting time. Now, there was an official, what a fool, who wrote in a memo, said, yes, it's gaming the system a bit, but you have to know the rules of the game you are playing. A game? These are people's lives, but hey, this is what happens in large bureaucracies. Now, moving ahead to 2013, this is still going on. Now, mind you, the law was passed back in 1996 that said there had to be appointments in 30 days. And in 2013, they said there were still thousands of patients who didn't have their appointments for colon cancer screening. Over 50 patients had delayed diagnosis of colon cancer and later died. That was just from the 2013 report. By 2014, it looked like nothing had changed. At least 120,000 vets had never gotten care. Many, many more said they had to wait well over a month. There were still the disparities between the reported wait times and the actual wait times, and the schedulers admitted that they had one list that were the real appointments, and then they had another list that had the made-up appointments that made it look like there were no waiting times. The Phoenix VA was particularly bad. There was a 71-year-old fellow who went in September with blood in his urine. His family said he was sent home to be seen in 1 week by a primary care doctor or a urologist, and that the situation was urgent. After he was sent home, his family said they were told, get this, there was a 7-month waiting list and that there were other critical patients. Well, this poor fellow died at the end of November from his bladder cancer. This is unbelievable. It's like out of a movie. The family said the VA called on December 6th, a week after he died, to make an appointment for him. Fortunately, we have a physician who was a whistleblower And he came forward and gave true evidence about the official list and these unofficial lists that we talked about earlier, the way they game the system. At least 1,700 veterans at the VA who wanted an appointment were never placed on the waiting list. This was at the Phoenix VA. Los Angeles VA was not much better. We had similar numbers. 400 veterans waited at least 6 months for an appointment, and with average wait times being sometimes 3 months, 4 months. Here's the worst of this whole debacle. There's no accountability, and this is so typical with the government. So all these shenanigans, what happened? Yet again, a House Committee on Veterans Affairs held a hearing about preventable patient deaths. Okay. Some of the congresspersons accused the VA of failing to discipline the officials who were responsible for these patients' deaths. Well, what happened? They got performance bonuses. Yes, performance bonuses. $200 million ended up being paid in wrongful death lawsuits. Thank goodness for the lawsuits. So that money that went to the performance bonuses should have been going to lawsuits, but at least the families were compensated in some way. 20 years after the law mandating the 30-day appointments, still there's tons of VA patients whose appointments are delayed 90 days or even more, sometimes even double that. So yet more congressional hearings, yet more statements saying, oh, there's systematic and programmatic failures and we're not delivering quality care and quality time. Finally, somebody did something about it. May 2018, when Trump was president, he started and got something going called the VA Choice Program. And that bill was bipartisan. Thank goodness the Congress people stepped up to the plate. And under the law, if the VA couldn't provide the vet with the level of care they needed or expected or had long wait times, the veteran could get care in the private sector. Private sector pulls through again. And I personally know many folks who have used this option and it's working well. Hopefully it will continue to work well, and our veterans who deserve it more than anyone else, certainly now with the horrible injuries that they're returning home with, deserve to get the care quickly and deserve good care. I just want you to keep this in mind. The Veterans Administration is the current model of a government-sponsored single-payer health system. Think about that when people start talking about single payer, given all those years to finally try to get it straight. And how do they get it straight? By getting the private practitioners involved. So given the government's track record, even the most jaded bureaucrat can't justify these kinds of betrayals of patients' rights and the public's trust. We don't want these people controlling our words, certainly through the Ministry of Disinformation. And we certainly don't want them controlling our health. We need physicians who we trust to be open and honest and critical thinkers. We don't want government puppets, but this is where it seems to be going. It's up to us as physicians to learn how to just say no when we're asked to do things that don't sit right with us, and plenty of times you know this comes up, and they're starting to attack conscience protections that are in the law now. I think we'll have to do a whole nother podcast on that. So we speak up as physicians and as patients who people actually listen to. Speak up. Just say no. Say, I want good care, and I want good care now, and I want good care from the doctor I want it from. So with all those horrible things in mind, we have to still be positive. We still have our own minds, our own hearts. We have our families. We have our personal doctors. Have these conversations. And if you know something your doctor doesn't know, don't be afraid to tell him or her and say, you know what? I learned this on America Out Loud, Pulse. And we're five different doctors, Dr. Jordan Vaughn and Dr. Stuart Tankersley from Concerned Doctors, and Dr. Peter McCulloch, Dr. Peter Bregan and Ginger Ross Bregan, and with scientist Dr. James Lyons Weiler, say, I learned a lot of stuff and you might be interested to know it. And who knows, maybe they'll listen. Now, you know, we're on every weekday at 5 with an encore presentation at 10 and on iHeartRadio at 8 a.m. the next morning. And all of our shows go direct to podcast in 24 hours. And you can hear them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, iHeart, and others. So whether you agree or have other opinions, please share the show. And until next week, say it loud. I'm free and I'm proud.